Hi everyone, it's been a while, but we're back with some amazing content from countries all over the world. I'm super excited about the country we're focusing on today. It's a country that really impressed and inspired the world recently during the World Cup. I believe you know what country I'm talking about. Yes, it is Qatar. I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Fatima today, who is an educator and scholar from Qatar, who will talk to us about her work, which is really impressive. She will also give us some context about education in Qatar in general so that we would understand the effort of the country in advancing education in so many directions and so many venues. Dr. Fatma, I'm very, very pleased to have you today. Welcome to our podcast.
Hello, assalamu alaikum. How are you?
Excellent.
Thank you so much for having me today. I'm so pleased and honored. I was very happy to learn about your the center or institute you're speaking from, and it's nice to know about any endeavor that tries to connect human experience, because at the end of the day, this is exactly what it should be.
Correct. I totally agree with that. And that's actually the focus of Universal Narratives, connecting professionals, connecting people, learning about the experiences of people all over the world so that we can reflect on our own practice and improve as individuals, as professionals, as organizations. So why don't we start by asking you to introduce yourself to us, your background, experience, education, so we can get a clear picture about where you're coming from.
Okay, so well, let me start that I come from a family where my father and mother were barely literate. They only knew how to read and write. My father used to read the Quran, and he learned to read it at the local Quran school. And my mother only studied until the second grade, but
Okay.
they really loved learning, and they read as much as they could. And for them, it was, they always encouraged us, and they cherished education as a privilege and as a right that they've never had the access to.
Yes.
So from age, I've learned to appreciate reading and appreciate education in general. So I went on to college, and I finished a double major in education and English. It was a joint bachelor degree. So I studied all through my education here in Qatar, you know, at a time where English was only introduced in the fifth grade. We used to learn in Arabic and then learn English from the fifth grade, just the basics.
Yeah.
So I worked in Qatar University for a while. I went to do my master's degree in England, and it was my first experience outside the Gulf region.
Yeah.
I was impressed and intrigued by the culture, by the attitude to education, and I finished my master's and went back to Qatar University to teach. I like literature, English, a bit of linguistics, and I also did some teaching practice with the students that we call them teacher students, where they went to schools to practice their teaching.
Yes.
After a while, I wanted to finish my PhD after my, you know, as most scholars do. So I went to University of Oxford, where I got a second master's degree, but this was a master's of science. I did applied linguistics. And then, I mean, I did that because I really wanted to go in depth and study bilingual education. At the time, you couldn't even make me stop talking about bilingual education. For me, it was really interesting to see how people can learn two languages and function in two languages, and what makes some people preserve the first language while others don't, and how can we balance, and how can the schools do this balance. So I graduated in 2013. I finished my PhD, and the topic was bilingual education, models of bilingual education in Qatar. I used the Qatari model as a case study, and I did you know, document analysis and lots of field work to see, to compare two kinds of schools in Qatar, and study their policies and their policies towards language and how they balance use within the classroom and within all their teaching, either documents or their teaching practice. So, I mean, After my PhD, I worked as a, I mean, since that time until now, I always worked as a consultant, first in education above all. I'm sure many of you heard about Education Above All. It's a non-profit organization that was founded by Her Highness Sheikha Moza. And main aim of Education Above All was to reach students, children, all over the world and give them access to education. You've a child, and how is that really influencing the worldwide scene in reaching underprivileged children? So I worked there as a consultant for a couple of years. During that time, I did a lot of work with the World Bank, with the UNESCO, either on policies, on strategies, and even on the projects on the ground.
Yeah.
And then for a while, I thought I wanted to direct my efforts locally. And then I thought the best place to do that is the Ministry of Education. So I get the Ministry of Education and Higher Education as a consultant in the private education sector. For me, this is really interesting because usually there is a great divide between research and practice and the actual policies. So my role is to use research-based to inform the policymakers of research, and so they can make research-based decisions in their policies and strategies relating to education from all over the field, whether it be it for private education, for education relating to SEN, homeschooling, you name it. I've been involved in many many projects and many strategies and policies.
I love all of that. So, you know, we share a very similar background because I also a big part of my career focused on bilingual and bilingual education and language education in general, different languages and second language acquisition, etc. But then I'm like you too. I don't like to be only limited to one field of education. So I have been also doing research on other parts or other aspects of learning and teaching as well. So I focus a lot on teacher education, research-based practices, teacher identity, the relationship between socio-political events that are happening in the community around us and how that impacts classroom practices. And I love the focus on local efforts to improve education because honestly, like you can be contributing in so many different ways to education all over the world, but then as somebody who comes from like a specific country or a specific culture, you know that place very well, and you are the most equipped and skilled person to give back to that community and the most also able to give back to this culture. So I love that giving back to the Qatari culture and Qatari Ministry of Education, because again, you come from that background, you understand the context, you know how to deal with the people, you understand the needs of the teachers and the students, and you also have a very strong research background to support that.
Yes, I mean, I do agree with that, and that I read your bio and I saw how I think most educators, even if they specialize in one field, they're still interested in all things that has to
Yes.
do with education,
Correct.
and that's only natural. And what's interesting is that I also found a lot of my colleagues I met last year when I published my first children's book. I'm not sure what is it about people in education and publishing children's
Yeah.
So
Do you want to tell me a little bit about your book? Because I find this very interesting too. I can tell you a little bit about my inspiration. My inspiration is that my kids are bilingual and multiracial, and they live in the most diverse city in the world. And I feel that the books that they read in the classrooms are not always representative of their very unique cultures and backgrounds. And so I really wanted to contribute to books that represent different cultures, backgrounds, languages in our public school system. And that's why I wrote my book during the pandemic in 2020,
yeah,
actually. Yeah.
Exactly, same time. But my intention were mostly Individual, if you'd say. I wanted to, because I lived in an era as a child, which was really different than the era that children are living now. I
Correct.
wanted to capture those memories, and so I wrote them as poems a long time ago. But the
Nice.
poems were so simple, they're one-line poems in Arabic, that they sounded like a children's book. So I thought, okay, this line could be this, and so it almost like naturally became a story. And then I published it during the pandemic. We had a lot of free time during the lockdowns.
Correct.
So I did that, and once you go ahead and contact a publisher and an artist, it becomes easier. Before that, for me, it felt like a colossal task, but once I did it, it was easier than I thought. I
Yeah.
just contact certain people, send them the script, and voila. No, it's not as difficult. It's just that to have the courage to get started.
Correct. I agree with you. It's just the first step. Sometimes we're so worried about the first step, but once you take that first step, then it's much easier afterwards.
So the one story, there are three, it's like a series. So the first one is about a palm tree that my mother planted the seed when she was pregnant with me. And she used to tell me that story all the time, that this palm tree is as old as you are. And then we moved that palm tree to the new house. It became very tall. I was always the first one to pick the dates. So it was a very true and real experience that the children found. I mean, when I go to book reading, the children really find it fascinating, and it connects them to their culture, to their roots.
Correct.
And the other stories, one is still coming up, inshallah, in a couple of months, and the third one to follow. And they all also connect the students to their culture and identity. And I think one of your questions was that, and I was very keen to answer that question. Is that how, when you asked about what you proposed to us about how Qatar is progressing in many sectors but preserving its unique identity.
Yeah.
To answer that, first of all the policies and strategies here in Qatar have a culture and identity factor when they are devised. So it's built in any policy or strategy that's being devised by the committees, whether it be education, be sports policy, any activity or policy or strategy that's being published and put out to the public, it has an identity factor. And I mean, personally, this comes from His Highness the Emir himself when he was the heir apparent. And the schools were diverse, and people were starting to lose their Qatari identity, or how the schools look and what. So there was a decree that everybody should wear, and they should be allowed to wear their Qatari thobe, their Qatari
Yeah.
clothes. And that started like an onset of being proud of it. Because
Yes.
when your leadership is inducing that kind of encouraging being Qatari and being proud of your identity, how you look, how you talk, instead of just being melted in whatever other old cultures, and all cultures are important and to be appreciated. But one has to start with his own culture. You have to appreciate your own culture to be able to appreciate other cultures. And so it started then, and from then on, all the schools had to do, I mean, the schools, there are laws in place that the schools have to teach Arabic. All Muslim students have to do Islamic studies, and they can't finish their high school without having finished a certain credit of Arabic and Islamic studies. The schools, they have like a cultural code. So all of this, as I said, is induced within the policies, the strategies, the bylaws. And I think this is the best way to start it. There is so
Yeah.
much that you can do by public effort. But if you start it that way, then it is easy for leadership in the school districts or leaderships in the municipalities to take that on and introduce any programs that really embrace the Qatari culture. And we saw how that was, it really played well. It gave the World Cup a very special if you say taste, it was
Correct.
different because it has that. Then, if you don't induce the culture and if you don't introduce it to the public, then every other World Cup would look the same. But it's
Correct.
different. You have to see.
Yeah.
You have to see what is it to be a Qatari. And as I said, it encourages all the youth, all the young people, instead of just embracing a global identity, they were very proud of their Qatari identity.
Correct. I love everything that you said. I think it's really, really important to value and embrace that local identity and the identity of each child before they're able to embrace a global identity. And I think of myself as a global citizen, but I still really appreciate my roots and my own identity as a Arab woman, as a Muslim woman, and as somebody who lived in the Middle East for part of my life. So all of that I'm really very proud of, but that does not mean that I'm not open to learning about other people and other cultures. It actually facilitates the process because, as you said, when you are in a like a healthy kind of relationship with your own identity and you actually value your identity and see how important it is, it helps you see that it actually a means to connect with other people and just learn about the world in general. Speaking your own language, learning about your own customs and traditions, it shouldn't really be any hindrance or any kind of obstacle on your way of learning about other people. It actually facilitates that process in so many ways.
Yeah, and it worked really well in the World Cup, and
Yes.
people were very welcoming of all of people. I mean, it was such a joy to go to the local places like Souq Waqf, and we can point out, look, these are the Argentinians and these are the Brazilians. And as I said, if you can have as you said, a healthy relationship with your own identity, a culture, then you start to appreciate all those people who were coming here to Doha to enjoy the World Cup.
Yeah, the World Cup was really impressive. Like we were watching it here in New York, and every time I was telling my husband, "Oh, I wish I was there." It's so amazing because it was just very unique how I could see the culture very clearly. But yeah, seeing the culture, as you said, it was evident in such a way that the generosity, the welcoming culture, the warmth, the family feel was there, plus also embracing all global cultures and just being open to different differences, etc. It actually, like embracing your own culture helps you understand that it's okay for other people to be different because everyone is different. And at the end of the day, our differences makes the world more interesting. The diversity always makes the place more interesting, just different perspectives, different backgrounds and experiences. It's okay to be who you are, but at the end of the day, we can still be friends. We can be very close. We can learn about each other, etc.
Exactly, and it portrayed the Arabic generosity culture. I mean,
Correct.
you, the
Yes.
His Highness the Emir, the father, was saying this is the World Cup of the Arabs, and that also kind of bonded the Arabs,
Correct.
and in a way to represent also the culture and break some maybe stereotypes that are related to
Yes.
the Arab image.
Correct. I think that the changing the stereotypes was very, very well done during the World Cup because people could see, like I was just thinking of like how people were seeing even on TV all the time they were seeing people who look different, come from different backgrounds. The hijab was always there, which
Yeah.
is something that people don't know so much about, and sometimes they have misconceptions about Muslim women and why they wear the hijab, etc. But they were able to see very accomplished figures with their headscarves. It's a normal scene in the daily life of so many people all over the world. So even if you're not accustomed to seeing this in your own local communities, it exists in other parts of the world. And people are very comfortable being themselves in other parts of the world. And I like that. I like that so
Yeah.
much.
It was great. Yes.
Yes. So we are going to move now to just maybe you briefly telling us about like the different kind of schooling models and systems in Qatar. I know there is a lot of private schools, there is a lot of international schools, and also there is public schools. So if you can just briefly maybe discuss the difference between all these different models and systems.
Yes. If there is something that we like in Qatar is change and transformation, and one might look at it in a negative way, but for me, from my perspective as a scholar and as a person who studied the schooling system in Qatar during the transformation and right now and doing field work before, I always say that it's a journey and it's versatile, and we as a nation learned so much from it. Education in Qatar began in the 1950s. I think there were only two schools to accommodate the population at the time. And then we look back in 2001, whether, you know, the schools were booming. There was a new initiative called Education for a New Era. So from all these changes, what we ended up right now with, you have roughly three types of schools. First, you have your public schools. These are just publicly run, kind of centralized leadership schools. And the language of education in these schools is Arabic. There is the local curriculum, the Qatari curriculum. And you get a high school diploma at the end of a 12-year schooling system. Then there are the private schools. And the private schools, interestingly, have been growing so rapidly in the last at least 10, 12 years. There are so many types of private schools, and by now almost 40%, I think that statistics 60% of students in Qatar go to private schools.
Okay.
40% of them are Qataris, and most of them are in the primary stages, but there's still many of the students in Qatar attend also secondary stage in a private school. The reason for that is we also have what we call a voucher system. So if you're Qatari and you want to attend a private school, and that school, that said school is you know, after being assessed and evaluated by the Ministry of Education, you can provide the school with a voucher that pays for the education of the child. That was part of the initial Education for a New Era initiative, where parents have choice. Parents have choice. And the aim for that initiative was to provide choice and provide a healthy competitiveness between public schools and private schools. So the private schools mostly here in Qatar are either following British curriculum, American curriculum, and the International Baccalaureate. There are many community schools. We've got schools from every country you can think of: Finnish schools, Japanese schools, Spanish schools. So the schooling system is very versatile. It offers anything you can think of in that term. And the population in Qatar now is almost 3 million. 20% of them are Qatari. 80% are non-Qataris. But because Qatar is becoming, you know, an attraction either in commerce, in economy, we do expect to have a lot of expatriates. So these schools, they cater for the expats and they cater for Qataris as well. And thus variety of schools.
Yeah, that's great actually. It's great to see that the Qatari families are also interested in different models and types of schools. And again, this goes back to the idea of diversity of choices. And I know Qatar is a place because of the expat experience attracts a lot of people because of so many reasons, the economy, businesses, etc. So there is a lot of people who are attracted to live in Qatar, and such a great and diverse place to be. But it's great to see that the Qatari families are also interested in exploring the different models and different systems. And I believe it's also healthy for the international schools to have Qatari children, because it's one way of like mixing with local communities. You don't want schools to be segregated. You want schools to be able to serve the entire community, whether it is foreigners like expats or Qatari citizens, because it just, you know, it's great. The cultural connections between people is always something that we value as educators. And I know you agree with that.
Yes. Yes, I do agree with that. And having these kinds of schools, as I said, when you give people choice, only the best schools can survive. And, you know, you might have some smaller schools catering for lower SES, you know, demographics, people who cannot really afford big, expensive private schools, when we also have those. And there is room for everybody. And even in my, as I'm speaking about it today, I am happy and proud that we have this, if I might call it, a bouquet of different types of school. There are also specialty schools. The specialty schools are sort of vocational schools. Sort of, there is a banking school.
Yeah.
These are public schools for boys and girls. They're segregated. There are science schools, a couple of STEM schools.
Yeah.
And I think they're opening a new school that really, that is, you know, it's a new project, and it's attached to the Qatar Museum, the Qatar National Museum, and the Islamic Museum. And that should be interesting to have these specialty schools that do the normal programs, but as well they have these other specialty in them, and it attracts a lot of parents to provide a different way of education, if you might say.
Yeah, that's wonderful. So we spoke about your journey. We spoke about your amazing accomplishments. I would like you now to reflect on your role as a Qatari educator, a female Qatari educator who's working tirelessly to improve the quality of education for all children in your country. How do you see your own role specifically to you?
Yes, that question makes me sound like a superwoman.
Educators are superwomen.
I think, you know, recently I'm also changing departments, where I'll be the head of a type of a training center that contributes to the training of leadership, school leaders and teachers, not only for Qatar, but for the Gulf region. I can't really specify where, because it has not been finalized.
Yeah.
But that's also a new position that I'm looking forward to. So I have a vision. I have a vision of education in the region where students from all types of background can surpass traditional education, traditional paper exams, and have access to more dynamic ways of education. I think education should be inclusive, not only for SEN students, but children of all learning needs, of all learning abilities, and all learning aspirations. I understand that all SEN access for students with special needs is very vital in education, but that should not leave us to forget the bigger picture, that students come of, you know, from all kinds of homes, backgrounds. Education should be, as I said, dynamic and accessible, and it should be enjoyable. And that's one vision I have. So when I started dealing with education and studying education, it was always out of passion for transformation, as I said, the human experience. I like when I go to schools and you see children smiling and actually engaged without being forced to. And, you know, opposed to that, then you have students in secondary schools where sometimes they're struggling with their examinations, they're struggling with their traditional education. So, I mean, I know I've sidelined from the question, but I think my journey is that I always had a vision in mind. When I wanted to do the PhD, I really liked a bilingual education. And I said to myself, I want to study in the best university of the world. I was proud of it. I was proud that I was accepted in Oxford. I was proud that I graduated from Oxford. I'm proud that I'm also a role model. I mean, it's nice to go and see younger girls speaking to me and being happy to for me to explain my experience and telling them, you know, the thing I stress is that even if you don't get what you want now, your goal is still there. I did two masters, I did a PhD, I have a family. Just take it slowly and you will get there. There's no time limit. Everybody's story is different.
Correct.
So right now, when I'm working with policies and strategies, it always gives me a privilege and a responsibility to induce all the change that I aspire for within the policies and strategies that I'm working with. I mean, lately I was working for 2 years on the homeschooling policy in Qatar, because the public sector schools, they accept students to be homeschooled, whereas at the private education, you know, students who don't speak Arabic usually just opt for online education if they want to do homeschooling for any medical, religious, or educational need. So I've been working on the policy for 2 years. It's in the preliminary stages. Inshallah, we will, you know, apply and see how we can tweak it and make it a more robust policy.
Yeah, I love that. And just a comment on what you said. I love everything that you're saying, because I'm also, I have like a very similar vision in terms of like inspiring other people. Like when I reflect on my journey and what kind of schools I went to when I was a child, and then I was always determined to actually pursue more degrees and just expand my knowledge in education. I started my career as a special educator, and then I started doing bilingual education, and then I did another master's just like you in educational leadership, and then my PhD was in instruction and curriculum. So it's more like about policy, teacher training, etc. And I always tell the girls, like the young women around me, that it's not easy. You see the accomplishments, but it's not easy, and it doesn't go like in a linear kind of manner. It's an ups and downs process. But
yes.
as long as you're determined and you have something in mind, there is nothing that should stop you. It takes time. It's okay. As you said, everybody has their own journey. Everybody has their own story. And you just make it work based on what you have. But eventually, if you have the determination, the you know, the focus, continue dreaming and go for what you want.
I had some time between my first master's and my PhD, and during that time I partnered with a few people, and we started a school. I'm no longer officially with the school, but it was one of the most beautiful adventures I took, is because it gives you a hands-on experience.
Correct.
About everything you've been reading about. It's very easy to write a paper about school leadership. It's
Correct.
Not as easy to actually be in a school leadership role. And every school is different. Every context is different. It always gives me, it keeps my feet on the ground, as you might say. Even now, as I do the policies and strategies and I do the reports, that experience, as well as my other experiences with the school in the field, always keeps my feet in the ground. It's easy to put so many regulations, but you have to understand you're giving them to people, to human beings,
yes,
who might do some of them, might not be able to do some of them. And you can pick the most important. You can prioritize this, not just you know, work from a paper and give that to school leaders and say this is what you're supposed to do. So these field experiences did really keep my feet on the ground when it comes to policies, when it comes to strategies, even when it comes to writing papers.
I love that. So it's not, so the hands-on experience kind of like informs how you propose new ideas, how you propose new initiatives, because you're always keeping in mind that it's going to impact people, and it's going to impact families, and it's going to impact teachers. And so having had these experiences yourself helps you kind of think about what is the most feasible way of kind of introducing these ideas and making sure that they actually work.
I was also involved in, you know, during the pandemic, at the beginning everybody wanted the students to stay home, and some people wanted the students to go to school. So the hybrid learning that was employed in Qatar. We were a committee, and I'm proud to say that I was one of the people that suggested the kind of hybrid education that enabled the students to keep going to school some of the days and to study online some of the other days. So education in Qatar was only disrupted completely maybe for only no more than 6 months. And even during that period, online platforms were up and running. I'm so proud of that, because I know a lot of countries in the region took them as long as 6 months to actually have platforms set up. But in Qatar, we had one platform. It wasn't really functional. So they changed it within a week. The second week, everybody was using Microsoft Teams and schools were going. I mean, it cannot be the same as going to, you know, face-to-face education. But this really, education was not disrupted. Me as a parent, I saw that it wasn't as disrupted as it was expected. And I know Qatar is a privileged country and can do that. And that might not be the case for access and connectivity in other places. But I was proud to be on that team as well.
Yeah.
I'm also right now the board member of EA schools that cater for students, out of school students in Qatar. And we can talk more about that.
Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that, since we are talking
Yes.
about your impact?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So I worked with education above all as a consultant in the past, but recently I was invited as a board member for four schools. They are called As Salam School, and this is very beautiful, because As Salam is a local plant. It's a natural plant that comes out in the desert. So they named the schools after this local plant, and the reason for the schools being here in Qatar is that when we look at the statistics, there are still many out of school students in Qatar. I think there are no more than 2 or 3%, but still that's a, you know, a good number. You don't want any student to slip through the cracks. And while education above all is looking to encourage education outside of Qatar and to make sure students are getting an education, it's only natural and logical to look inside and see if students in Qatar here are also in need of, you know, schools that cater for this kind of education. So when we looked at the World Bank statistics and looked deeply and stratified the data, because some students would come inside Doha and leave. Some were homeschooled, but they're not registered. Some were deceased, or they went back to their country. But still, there was a number around 3,000 students that don't attend school because of their own cultural background. These mostly are from low-income families, very low-income families, non-Qatari. Most of them are, mainly they are from Pakistani, Indian, many Asian countries, and they have very low income, and for their own cultural, I think, outlook, they don't teach the girls or even the boys. They might just go to the first grade, second grade, they don't teach them. So one big challenge was to encourage them to register in the schools. Mm-hmm. So now there are five SLM schools. One is completely Arabic speaking. They follow the Qatari curriculum. Two are British curriculum schools. There is one for boys and one for girls. These are secondary schools also. I think there will be a new one which is mainly bilingual. There are many challenges, but you know, when becoming a board member, I got also a view of the efforts that people are doing in these schools to get people in the school to register, to get the funds locally for the students. And it's beautiful, because, you know, the families might not be interested in educating the kids, but the kids are really interested in education. They're, if you go to normal schools, you know, you have your, some of the kids will be enthusiastic, some of the kids will be normal. When you go to these schools, all the kids are really really, really,
yeah,
really happy and very happy that they're actually in the school and they have their backpacks, their
yeah,
books, and actually studying. It's so refreshing, and it's I mean, for me, it's a pleasure to watch that, and then I come back home and preach my kids. You're privileged to go to school. You
Yes.
should, you should really appreciate, and it is something important to be involved in.
Yes.
The families might not be aware of the importance of educating, but we are aware, and thus we have a responsibility to provide these children with schools. And alhamdulillah, with the efforts of, as I said, Her Highness Sheikh Hamouza, the education above all, educate a child. Now we have many of these schools, inshallah, and we're trying to close the number by, inshallah, within a couple of years.
Yeah, I love the work of education above all. I have been actually following it, and I know that they do a lot of work internationally. I have been looking at the impact of like places like in Asia and all over the world, South America, etc. But I love seeing that it's also part of the effort of the organization to impact Qatar itself and support the families that are not really able to educate their kids, whether it's because of cultural, you know, background or because of like financial resources, etc. And it's great. Like, you know, I believe this is something that every educator wants to do as well. Like, you're doing work that is fulfilling, helping you grow as a professional, but you also feel like, oh, I have to also do something for the community. I have to do something where I feel like I drive meaning as a human being. I'm making other people happy by just watching, as you said, how excited the kids are to just go to school and have that normal school experience that everybody else, all the other kids, including my children also, just because you said your kids take for granted, right? So
Yes, they do. They do.
yeah.
I mean, and then if you'd ask about my main role or how I see myself as an educator, I always see myself as a person who raises awareness and motivates transformation.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you don't, you know, I might not publish as much or you know, do the groundwork myself, but I see myself as a champion, if you'd say, as an advocate. I like to advocate. I like to push people and motivate them and get the work done towards what the plans, towards the strategies, and also add the human ingredient.
Yeah, I love that. So that would actually take me to my next question, which is, what can we learn from your own personal life as a female educator from Qatar who's very passionate about making a difference in her country? So what would be like some lesson that we can learn from your experience, given you shared your beautiful background with your parents and how they encouraged education, even though maybe they did not have the same kind of schooling experiences, how they encouraged you, how you were so motivated as a young girl to like pursue different degrees in education and just, you know, develop yourself as a professional. What can we learn from your own personal experiences? Or in other words, what is a message that you would like girls and maybe young women all over the world to learn about you and from your experience?
Yes, thank you for this question. And as I said before, you do make me sound like a superhero. Well, first of all, I mean, one should make good use of his or her time.
Yeah.
Maybe because we grew up in an era that didn't have the internet, but we also had TV. But then sometimes if I take a break, I say I'll watch 20 minutes of TV. So I watch 20 minutes, and even if the movie was interesting, I would turn it off. So
yeah.
I'm not saying it's easy to do that, but making good use of your time, and you as a mother probably relates. Because,
yeah,
you know, if you want to have comfort, between quotes, that's not something that can be easily achieved. Even if you're relaxed, you still have your mind going. So making good use of your time is always a good idea. you know, applying for coursework. The internet now is full of resources. So I will encourage young girls and boys and the younger generation to make use of that. We didn't have that as we grew up. We went to books and we read the books. And the other thing is that to have some clear goals in mind, even if it was not your number one passion. When you have a goal and pursue it for some time, and I would quote, I can't remember who exactly right now, is that you pick something. I mean, you pursue it for a certain amount of time, then even if you quit, you're not starting over. You're starting from that point of experience, and then have passion for what you do. Because it will not be easy for someone to do a podcast at 7, you know, in the evening, or go do something that's work related in the weekend, as long as you put your heart into it. I'm not thinking I'm working for the government. No, I'm thinking I'm working towards a goal. All of this is going for the common good. You go in any project with a giving mindset instead of you know, promoting oneself.
Yeah.
There is something about me that I try to eliminate, that I'm trying to, if I start to introduce myself, I do try to put Oxford now. But because it was an achievement, but I'm still very modest about it. I feel modest about saying, you know, I'm a Oxford graduate. I said, no, I'm not going to start with that. I try to put it in the conversation because I keep thinking to myself, you know, you owe it to encourage others to do this and that.
Yeah.
And it's an achievement. You worked so hard. Getting in was hard. Studying was hard.
Yes.
But for me, I go into an interview or a project thinking, what can I give?
Yeah.
How can I help?
Yeah.
I mean, if you start with that mindset, nothing bad is going to come out of it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's a matter of also remembering that getting all these degrees and stuff like that is a privilege, and it's a personal accomplishment. But what really matters is, how can I use this knowledge? It's like I owe my community something, and I want to make sure that I actually serve the communities that I belong to. And it's also part of the Muslim kind of tradition, because you always feel that seeking knowledge and gaining so much knowledge is a blessing. And so it's like you have to pay sadaqah or zakah.
Zakah, zakat al-ilm, subhanAllah.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to pay like zakah for the knowledge. Exactly, exactly. That's how I feel as well. And we're so privileged in so many ways, but you also want to make sure you empower people. You're not using that, as you said, for like personal accomplishment, but you're using it as a means to develop communities and support others in ways that they might not realize, but you are aware of. And because you're aware of, you're responsible, just like you said.
Exactly, because we are aware of it. And sometimes when I'm writing a report and I'm tired and I'm thinking, oh, why can I, maybe I can write it tomorrow, I remind myself of my crying days in Oxford and say, you know, you did that, so you can do this. So the crying days cannot go to waste. Let's finish this as an Oxford graduate.
Yes, I love it. I love that. So my last question to you would be reflecting on the Qatar experience, because people are very curious to learn about the country and what's happening in the country. What is one message that you would like professionals and educators all over the world to know about Qatar and educators like yourself?
Qatar is such a special place. The context is unlike any in the world. If you would like to study any aspect of education in Qatar, whether in the past, you know, temporally, or right now in the new initiatives that are coming, I would encourage anyone to come and do such research or such inquisition, because it is interesting and because it's unique and it's unlike any other country in the world, if I'm allowed to say that, because of the diversity, because of the uniqueness of the community, because of the mix of the cultural and the global, because of the transformation that keeps happening. All of this makes it unique. It's a unique context that should be visited, appreciated, and maybe even written about.
I love that. I think it's a truly like a very unique place, and I love the mix between the tradition and the local identity with a global outlook. I think that's a very unique way of, and that's also a very unique context for a lot of people to explore and learn about, because sometimes in the process of modernizing and transforming, people kind of lose their identity, but Qatar is not losing its identity. And I love seeing that. And again, we discussed the World Cup and how this was so obvious and made such a great impression on so many people all over the world. So lastly, I would like to thank you so much for your time. It's I feel like I can talk to you for so long, and it's really enjoyable. I love talking to you. We have so much in common, and I really admire the work that you're doing in your community, giving back to the Qatari society and making sure that all kids receive quality education. This is not going to be our last conversation. I'm hoping we're going to be talking more in the future, but for now, thank you so much. And I look forward to connecting again in the future.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I would like to connect again, and maybe one day you can come and visit us. Also, talking to you, you didn't seem so far away in New York. So
No,
it was enjoyable and pleasant.
oh, thank you so much. Thank you.